Perfect. And just some quick reminder, registration closes on the Monday. Everyone must re-register, even if you were a delegate last year. Some resources, the conference webpage has a lot of resources. There's an ABC portal, which has all the information that you need. And it also contains a delegate handbook, which answers some questions about how to be a delegate. The delegate training from last weekend is also on the conference webpage. The agenda with links is on the conference webpage, and this presentation and audio will be on the conference webpage as well. All right, we are very glad to have Michael M. He is a parliamentarian, a professional registered parliamentarian. He's also certified professional parliamentarian and teacher with the American Institute of Parliamentarians. He's a certified governance trainer. And most importantly for us, he has over 30 years of service as a parliamentarian for different 12-step World Services conferences. So he's very aware of the 12-step concepts. And some ground rules. There will be portions for questions. Please limit your questions to 90 seconds to allow everyone a chance to ask questions. We may call people out of order. Given we only have a short time, please make sure you ask a question and avoid commentary. Chat will be disabled for this presentation so that it's not distracting. And the conference facilitators, which is me, Marcus, and William, will be available after for about 15 minutes to answer any questions. Okay, and with that, I'll go over to the parliamentarian slide. And I will hand it over to Michael.
Thank you very much, Carmen. Are the slides up? I'm not. Are you handling the slides or am I going to be sharing my slides?
I will handle the slides. Let me bring them up now. The slideshow.
Okay.
There we go.
There we go. Okay, so this is going to be a brief introduction to myself as the parliamentarian that's working with you and for you as your trusted servant at the upcoming ACA annual business conference, and all to the guiding principles that are used that I will be assisting the chairs with for the running of the meeting as far as meeting procedures are concerned. And that's my area of specialty, which is meeting procedures. Next slide, please. Okay, thank you. So the brief overview of the topics we'll be covering in this session, it's roughly split up 50-50. About half of the slides and half the presentation will be about the role of the parliamentarian, particular professional outside parliamentarian like me, so that you who are here today in the training will feel comfortable with that role and understand what that role is at the upcoming meeting. And I have been associated with the ACAABC based on prior experience with this group and my long-standing experience with other groups. They will explore the role of the parliamentarian, what those guiding principles and governing documents are that we're going to be using at the meeting. You're probably already familiar with them, but may not be familiar with the order in which these rules apply under standard parliamentary procedure. And when you think about it, it's the way you've actually been doing it. It just might not be familiar in the presentation of it. And what is the role of parliamentarian before, during, and after the conference? Then we'll move on to the other principal participants in the conference, the delegates, who are the primary people through whom the group conscience is going to be determined, and that's the whole purpose of the conference. And then the roles of the officers or lead servants of the in this conference, the conference chair, and the role of the conference chair in interaction with the parliamentarian. And because this is a fully virtual meeting, based on your past custom and your rules, you have certain individuals who serve as liaisons for the point of order, points of order that come up in the meeting. Another person who serves in the role of liaison or coordinator for points of information, and another person who is involved in World Service Organ Office points of information, or requests for information. And your terminology, I just pointed am pointing out here, the terminology that you've been using is the parliamentary term point of information. And in the more recent updates to most parliamentary guides, that's no longer called a point of information, because that is all kind of old-fashioned and confusing to many people. The term that's preferred nowadays is request for information. A point, when you say point of information, many people think that means I want to make a point of information, and that's actually what debate is for. If you want to tell people something that they haven't heard yet about the topic that's under debate, you just ask to participate in the debate or the discussion. The old-fashioned term point of information is really intended to be a request for information to someone else in the group who has more information about that issue. It could be the chair of the meeting, it could be the treasurer, could be the secretary, could be somebody involved in the administration of the office. So that's what something that I did want to clarify, what the roles of the main participants are. Next slide, please. A little background on myself personally. There are two organizations in North America that accredit parliamentarians for both the US and for Canada. And I am going to say, if you look at the title of this slide, it says parliamentarian slash meeting consultant. Only in the US do they call meeting consultants parliamentarians. And that word is derived from the British Parliament, because the procedures used in the British Parliament have high prestige because they've been used for almost 1,000 years at this point, and honed to be the most efficient and the most courteous and respectful rules for conducting meetings. And in the US, there is no confusion because we don't have a parliament. And when you call somebody a parliamentarian, people know you're talking about a meeting consultant. Everywhere else in the world, they say meeting consultant. And I just wanted to introduce that, because many people find the term parliamentarian and parliamentary procedure a little daunting, and moreover, very difficult to spell. So I like to point out that it's really just saying meeting consultant and meeting rules or meeting guides. So there are two organizations in the US and Canada that accredit: the National Association of Parliamentarians and the American Institute of Parliamentarians. Both, the first organization concentrates mostly on Robert's Rules, and the second is more focused on alternatives to Robert's Rules, which is the most well-known guide for parliamentary procedure that's out there. And I have the highest level of accreditation from both, and I've been on the opinions committee, and chair the opinions committee for both organizations. I am a certified governance consultant with BoardSource, so that includes a background in interpersonal dynamics in the nonprofit sector. I'm the past chair of the American Bar Association Nonprofit Organizations Committee, past president of the American College of Parliamentary Lawyers. I'm a long-term member and past chair of the Commission of Trust Funds in my hometown of Dedham, Massachusetts, which is an elected position. And for purposes of my work with this organization, I've worked with a number of 12-step organizations at the intergroup, national and international level for many years, including service as the regular meeting parliamentarian for Debtors Anonymous since 1999 and for Food Addicts in Recovery Anonymous since 2005. Next slide, please. And we'll have a couple of slides going over the role of the parliamentarian for those of you who may not be familiar with the role that the parliamentarian traditionally takes in most organizations that work with or hire a parliamentarian. The purpose of the parliamentarian is to serve as an advisor to the presiding officer because of the in-depth knowledge that the parliamentarian has about meeting rules. The presiding officer is intended to understand the group dynamics and the history and relationships involved in the group. The parliamentarian works with a number of groups over time, may become very familiar with particular groups, but the role of the parliamentarian is to be a meeting procedures guide to the chair and not a decision maker. Now, this is parliamentarian is someone who's not chosen to be the decision maker. It's chosen to be someone who will work with the elected officer, appointed officer, who is intended to run the meetings. Many times, an organization will hire a trained professional parliamentarian because that person has the background to know all the rules that might possibly apply in a particular situation. Not only know the rules, but also knows the alternatives that may be appropriate for a particular group and can advise about when in a less complicated alternative or an alternative that gives greater recognition to the role of and power to the members might be more appropriate. All these things are something that someone who's not trained, it doesn't really bring that body of knowledge with him or her. And when a trained parliamentarian works with an organization, that individual is usually from the outside of the organization. Sometimes an organization will say, we want you to be our parliamentarian, you go and get a credential. Some organizations prefer to have a member parliamentarian who doesn't have formal accreditation and training because that person knows the group dynamics of the organization and that's more important to them. That's also entirely appropriate. It's what the group decides is going to work best for that group. But it's often advised that the parliamentarian not be a member of the group in order to be completely objective and impartial. That way, the parliamentarian does not have any stake in the outcome of decisions and is there purely to ensure fairness, as to all participants. Next slide, please. Some of the key principles that the parliamentarian applies. A parliamentarian, even when it is a member parliamentarian, must be completely neutral and impartial in regard to the substantive issues that the group is discussing. The parliamentarian, even when it's a member parliamentarian, and that's not at issue here, cannot vote or join in debates. Again, in order to preserve the neutrality and impartiality of the person who's serving as parliamentarian. And what does the parliamentarian do? Parliamentarian offers an opinion to the chair or who is running the meeting at that time, does not make rulings, only the chair makes the rulings. The chair may rely on the parliamentarian, but the chair makes an ultimate ruling. Another thing that a chair may do is if a procedure is somewhat complicated, the chair might say, Mr. Parliamentarian, would you please explain to the group the procedure that we're going to be following during the discussion of this particular item? And I will then get up and put into plain English, to the extent that I can, the role and the procedures that we're going to be following. Typically, since I'm used to doing this, I can do that relatively well, put it in plain English. I do see a hand raised, and what I'm going to say is that the way we're going to handle questions is we're going to wait for a block of slides to go past, then we'll answer questions. If after we do that, there are questions that we don't have time to get to because of the time of the presentation, we'll put it off to the next block. And if at the end of the presentation, at the end of the presentation, the plan is we're going to have some extra time for Q&A. We will try and answer all the Q&A then. But if there are hands up and questions we're not able to get to in the time that we have, we will make an endeavor. You give us your contact information, and we will get back to you with the response to your question, but in your preferred communication method. Thank you. So, and I should also say, we plan on taking a group break for about 5 minutes between roughly 45 minutes and an hour into the program so that you can arrange timing if that's an issue or a concern for you, or you just need to stretch. Okay. Just a second, and I want to finish up with a block on role of the parliamentarian, and we have one more slide. Could we please advance to that slide, and then we'll take the questions. Okay. The role of the parliamentarian, why it matters. The parliamentarian helps to keep meetings legal, fair, and efficient because of the training that the parliamentarian has. That is something that the members can rely on and the chairs can rely on. We are trained to ensure that everyone's rights are respected because when the standard guides to running a meeting are followed, that's one of the most important considerations in how we organize the meeting procedures. And finally, what is very important for this particular group, the parliamentarian has an actual role under the OPPM in determining whether proposed alternative motions maintain the integrity of an original proposal. And the way we say that in parliamentary terms is within the scope of the notice. It's a concept that has parliamentary standard language, which some of you may be familiar with, or you may be more familiar with the terminology that's used in the OPPM. It's the same underlying concept. Now that we're finished with this block of slides on the role of parliamentarian, I see there is a hand raised. Could we please unmute the individual, Brad H., who has a question, and you can proceed with your question, sir.
Thank you, Michael. I appreciate that very much. Can you tell me what your opinion is of the conference being governed by the rules in the OPPM, which the delegates to the conference have never been given an opportunity to consent to be governed by the OPPM? And even the Board of Trustees has acknowledged that the OPPM does not govern the conference.
My understanding is by custom, the OPPM, it has been used historically for votes. It contains a very detailed set of procedures about how votes are to be conducted, and Appendix 10, and I believe the other one is Appendix 6, for the running of the meetings, have been followed by custom for a number of years. And because people are entitled to have some idea going into a meeting what the rules are going to be that are going to govern the meeting, custom has a very strong and highly recognized role, which we will discuss in a couple of slides that are coming up.
Yes, it's certainly true that that has been the custom. However, the Conference of Delegates has never been given the opportunity to say that whether they consent to that or not.
Well, again, it is custom, and it's a written custom. So it has a high level of value when there is an issue that comes up. If a particular procedure is challenged, then I will go over with you at the appropriate slide how that procedure
Thank
would
you.
be followed when that time comes.
Thank you. Do you believe that the conference could
Sorry,
request
Brad.
first contacts?
It's one question per person. And I want to make sure because we are limited, that we're able to get to everyone. So I'm going to just check in with everyone.
May I ask
Does
one
anyone
follow-up? May I ask one brief follow-up?
What I will do is I'll ask if anyone else has questions, and then at the end, you can ask your follow-up question. If at the end of this presentation, you can ask your follow-up question if we have time.
Thank you.
Does anyone else have any questions for Michael?
So we'll go on. If there are no further questions, oh, there is. Jim R. has a question.
Yeah, hi. So along these lines, is there any inference if no one has sort of challenged rules or customs in the past? I mean, the OPPM has been around for a long time, and people have had ample opportunity to fashion proposals or even to raise questions. So can anything be inferred because no one has up until now said, wait, this isn't.
Correct. That's it would take and we'll get to the procedure more in greater detail. I've appended to the responses some or to the resources page at the end some written opinions of the American Institute of Parliamentarians in regard to how to establish customary practice when the custom is challenged and those are available for reference. And we can discuss it more in later time. But the key issue is that long-standing custom creates an expectation, and that's the underlying principle. And so long as it is the custom, it will not and should not be varied without a formal vote by the body itself to say we want to establish a different rule. And there are many underlying reasons for that, but the point is expectations is one of the highest reasons why we continue to follow a custom unless it is determined to be otherwise. And when the custom is not clear, and again, this is for a later slide, there's a way of establishing what the custom is before we go on to then saying, well, we don't like what the custom is and we want it to be different. So all these things, most appropriately, there should be notice when things are going to be changed, without the body having some time to think about it, ideally. But at any rate, let's move on to the next question. I see BP from Bangkok has a hand raised, and then I think we'll get into the next series of slides.
Just real quickly, is this meeting saying that we're going to maybe focus more on the parliamentary rules, or are we still going to do kind of a mix between ACA and parliamentary rules? Thanks.
Oh, we will get to this in a later slide, thanks. But parliamentary rules govern when there's no written procedure that addresses that particular issue. And for that purpose, since the OPPM is a written procedure, even though it's adopted by custom, it has a higher value if it's in conflict with standard parliamentary procedure. I'll get into that in there is a later slide that addresses that issue. Thank you. Next slide, please. Okay. So the guiding principles that I'm going to be working with as a parliamentarian are based on the most commonly used parliamentary guides, which are included in the reference materials, and the service spirit of the ACA. And that's based on knowledge of the 12 steps, 12 traditions, and the 12 concepts, primarily in regard to meetings, the 12 concepts, knowledge of and familiarity with the AA concepts and how they're applied. And it's not a balance. It is very clear that the internal documents of the body are the highest governing rules, but we will also introduce, if necessary, a parliamentary or meeting guide principle when there is no other rule or procedure that's applied under the OPPM, for example. And given that, what we're going to do is we're going to say that the role of the parliamentarian is to be nonpartisan, to offer to the chairs the guidance of what these procedures, most commonly used procedures, are when there's no written rule for that particular procedure, and to keep in mind that the parliamentarian is in the role of a servant leader, not making rulings or decisions, but simply providing advice to the chair and to the members of the body. Next slide, please. Okay. Moral guiding principles, confidentiality and discretion. There are sensitive strategic discussions that have to take place before the meeting and to a certain extent during the conference, when with between the parliamentarian and the meeting chairs, in order to determine what the procedures most likely would be that would cover the particular situation, and in before the meeting, in particular, anticipated situations that are likely to come up. That's the reason that there may be a short break in the middle of a conference when the chair at the time will want to conference with the parliamentarian and see what the alternatives are and be advised before making a final rule on the issue. Because it's up to the chair, knowing and understanding the body, to make that ruling. The parliamentarian would say, well, for instance, this is what Roberts would say about how you handle this situation. Roberts is the most commonly used parliamentary authority, but other parliamentary authorities might handle this issue differently. You should do what you think is best for the organization, understanding that the body ultimately decides what the procedures will be that govern the body in a particular meeting. Again, the parliamentarian just advises. And the parliamentarian's role, particularly in the 12-step organizations, is to respect the group conscience of the delegates at the ACA who are establishing what the group conscience is for the entire fellowship. It's a highly spiritual matter, as you all know, and as you've been trained for your work during your work in the world of recovery, that group conscience is a spiritual issue that we have to come prepared to this meeting, understanding what our roles are, and that the conference is not a legal body under the 12 concepts, but is a spiritual body seeking to be informed by the voices of the other participants in the debate. And that is why we have meeting rules and procedures, so that every member, every delegate has the opportunity to voice his or her concerns, bring his or her information to the group in a fair way. That's the ultimate and most important role of the parliamentarian and of the chair. We're guides to help focus the conference and focus the discussion on the issues at hand in an efficient way. Next slide, please.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but may I ask why the co-host has disabled my video and continues to lower my hand?
I don't know. We said we would answer it. You had multiple questions. We said we would do that after the next block of slides. So I don't know.
The co-host has disabled my video and continues to lower my hand.
I can you answer that issue by private chat while we continue with the presentation? Can you please handle
Yeah,
that?
we're going to need to not allow people to unmute themselves for this interruptions.
Okay,
So,
thank you. Okay.
thank you.
We'll continue with our discussion of
You went
guiding.
to silence me, Mark.
Among the guiding principles, service is of highest value, not control. Control is not the primary issue. Occasionally, when things are getting out of control in a certain way, because history indicates that we know these things do happen. It's group dynamics. It's just the science of group dynamics. You've got enough people in a room with enough opinions. There have to be some underlying procedures that are going to govern who talks when and for how long. Otherwise, no one's voice will be heard. But myself and the chairs and the other people who are serving, like the point of order liaison and the request for information liaison, we are servants. We are there to help the group, the conference as a whole, achieve a group conscience. And that's what we keep high in mind when we're serving in those roles. Clarity and education. In large part because of the ACA's peer-led structure, the parliamentarian may also, in addition to advising the chairs during the meeting, educate the members and the delegates both before the meeting and during the meeting about procedures to increase their empowerment and their ability to participate actively in the meeting. Next slide, please. Okay. And again, okay, wait, what did I do? Here, I had said before we were going to talk about governing documents for the ACA. The chief governing documents for the ACA are the Articles of Incorporation and Bylaws. And those two documents are legal documents. They bind the board, which is a separate entity from the fellowship as a whole. The board is a servant of the fellowship as a whole and is necessary, and this is described in the 12 concepts, is necessary because we need a body that will have legal rights on behalf of the fellowship to produce literature, to provide literature, to liaise with communications, methods of communications that are necessary and that require a legal entity. Any time of formal communication in print or by radio or on the internet needs to be made on behalf of the fellowship of a whole as a whole. Someone has to do that who has a legal right to do that. Otherwise, anyone who wanted to could speak on behalf of the fellowship. So the Articles of Incorporation and the bylaws are legal documents and they govern the board. But under those documents, the board binds itself in several ways to be governed by the conference and the fellowship as a whole through the conference. And that is how the conference has an indirect legal role. But as we said before, the conference is primarily a spiritual body, and it is governed primarily by the 12 concepts. Again, we talked about custom. The OPPM has been followed for many years. It has not formally been approved, but it is has been approved in practice by its regular use. And that creates the expectation in the members from the point of view, or the participants from the point of view of participation and preparedness for the meeting, how they can expect things to be run. Certainly can be changed by the conference if the conference wishes to do so, and there are ways to do that. There are committees of the conference that are charged with governance related roles. And it can also be brought to the attention of the board through the conference. This is the way that there is a procedure for making changes if necessary. For right now, we have the OPPM that we have, and the anticipation is we will be using primarily Appendix X, the ABC voting rules, to determine what's going to happen at the ABC this year and how members and delegates are empowered to vote. Okay. Next are unwritten customary practices. And as I said, there are ways, if the custom is challenged, how to establish what the custom is. And if there are gaps, if there are things that are just not covered by any of these things above, Robert's Rules is the most well-known parliamentary guide. No parliamentary guide has been formally adopted by this body, which is fine. And when a parliamentary authority is formally adopted, that means that it does attain the quality of a written rule. Right now, these rules in Robert's Rules are just a custom. Robert's Rules can be used by many people as a synonym for general principles of common parliamentary law of meetings. When there's a consensus among the different well-known guides to parliamentary procedure or to meeting procedure, that's deemed to be common parliamentary law. And when they're different from each other, they provide alternative approaches to a similar issue, and a trained parliamentarian is able to fill in those gaps in conference with the chairs and address how to address almost any situation, because your existing rules, as is always the case with written rules, cannot foresee every possible alternative. So that's when we will bring in general principles of parliamentary law. Two of the most commonly used alternatives to Robert's Rules are books that I participated in updating in recent years. So I'm very familiar with both Roberts, which, when someone says Roberts Rules, most people think whatever meeting rules, whatever. But there's actually a book called Roberts Rules of Order, newly revised, which comes out with an update about every 10 years that brings the rules up to date to a certain extent. Well, for instance, the most recent version has much more about procedure on the internet and electronically and so on and so forth. Next slide, please. These slides are about how do we establish custom. I think, are there any hands raised at this time? I don't see any hands raised. So, oh, Charlie raised his hand. So, okay, Charlie, we'll take your question, please.
Thank you very much, Michael, and thanks so much for this presentation. This may or may not be exactly the right time, but it seems like an example of a customary procedure that I know I've personally been using since 2019. And
Okay, just hold on a second. If you don't mind, let me present the next two slides,
by all means, yes.
and you can ask your
Of
question.
course, absolutely.
Go
Thank you.
ahead. Thanks. Why don't we do that? I'll present the next two slides on custom, establishing custom. So it is the obligation of the presiding officer to use established customs in conducting the meeting whenever the presiding officer is aware of that custom. Both of your presiding officers have longtime experience with ACA in general and with the ABCs and also with your quarterly meetings. So they should be aware of most of your customs, but anybody gets deeply involved in where they are right then and there in the meeting and may not call to mind what the custom is in that time. When it happens that the chair of the meeting doesn't do something that a member thinks is in conflict with either a written rule or the custom, the member, the delegate in this case, can raise a point of order. So when that happens, the higher guy would be what's in writing, which is the 12 concepts and the OPPM. And they're written so people know and have known to read them and use them as a resource. So that is why they are of higher authority than the established group memory, which, as you know, when many people are involved, there can be conflict as to what that group memory may happen to be. So someone raises a point of order that the rules are not being followed, whether the rule or the practices and procedures are not being followed. And the presiding officer will then make a ruling as to, yes, you're right. Sorry, I got off track. I think that's not really a custom. We've done that a couple of times, but not enough time. But we've done it other ways too. And I don't think there's any real established custom about how to handle the procedures in this particular case. So the chair makes a ruling. And if the member is not satisfied with the chair's response, then it's the member who appeals. And the member could say whatever the chair says about what the custom is or whether there is no custom. The member can say, well, I think there is a custom and it's this. Or if the chair said, I think you're right, I think we have a custom and the custom is this, the member could say, I agree there's a custom, but it might be something else. And this is what I think it is. And then we have a short debate. And the body decides what the custom of the body has, in fact, been, whether there is a custom or not, whether it's been followed consistently enough to qualify as a custom or not, and whether they want to have some sort of a procedure, written procedure, to address this issue, this particular set of circumstances, the next time it comes up. Once the body has made a determination of what the custom is, that goes into the minutes and it becomes a written rule and has the quality of a written rule going forward. Let's see. So after that, I've done that slide. Charlie, I think it might be more appropriate to answer your question now. Go ahead. You're muted. Could somebody please unmute Charlie? Thank you.
We're good, but points for your ability to read body language over the Zoom here. So anyway, I want to come to one applied example of this because, we're kind of wrestling with different opinions based on something you said a few months ago. Certainly, since at least 2019, and heavily in the last couple of years, as we've been sort of going through a building of new kind of underlying, tools like a charter and other procedures. We have used non-binding polling of delegates. And it's, in my opinion, been very helpful in keeping committees on track with the conference and therefore sort of fill the spirit of the concepts. If we continue to do that, as expect one, at least one committee wants to, is there any procedural objection that you anticipate? Or if we basically say this is not binding, but we just want your guidance, should we go this way or that way when we come back to you in the next meeting? Is that okay from your perspective?
You're asking again for, it sounds like you're asking for a ruling, and I don't have a ruling. I have an
Yeah.
opinion only. And let me just tell you, because I have discussed this
Yeah.
previously with the chairs, Roberts hates non-binding polling in the middle of the meeting. And there are good reasons for that. It says you cannot do that. But remember, Roberts is not your established guide. Let me just finish briefly. I'm being told time's up, but let me just finish this briefly. So you don't have to follow Roberts. Other parliamentary authorities don't say you absolutely never can ever have a poll. So my position is, if it works for this group, then have a non-binding poll, but make it really clear that this is non-binding before you take it and after it's taken. So it's used for guidance only. And let me tell you why, Roberts. Let me tell you the underlying rationale. So really quickly, because we're out of time, is that once somebody's already voted once, there is a mental thing that clicks for people, and they feel stuck to that no matter. And it's subconscious, but this is the way the human mind works. You ask somebody to commit to something, it's very hard to get them off of it. So that's one reason. And the other reason is there's a tendency of people to go with the majority. So even though they may not have heard all the debate yet, and there's more debate to come, there's going to be a tendency on some people's part, totally subconscious, to just wait and hear what comes in next, that's really going to just change their mind from what the majority previously said. And the intent is to get all the information, value all the information equally, and then take a vote. That's why Roberts has the rule that it does. But once you know what the rationale is, you don't have an established rule that governs this. So do what you think is fair and works best for the group. That's where I come from. And I have discussed that with the chairs. And that's, I believe, where the chairs are going to be, if I understand our previous discussions. I see Carmen nodding her head. So I think that's where.
Thank you very much.
Just for your guidance. Okay. So we're out of time for additional questions, which we anticipated might be the case. So let's move on to purpose of the procedural rules. And let me try and get through the next couple of slides quickly. I think we need the slide before that. Can we get there? There. What are the purpose of procedural rules? There are a number of tensions that are group dynamics tensions that underlie the procedures that are used in the parliamentary or meeting governance, standard procedures. Efficiency versus education through debate. How quickly we need because to do this because we have limited time versus how in depth we're going to get. Majority rules versus minority rights. You understand through the 12 concepts and the right of appeal how important minority rights are, and you have the right of appeal or the minority opinion to make sure the minority rights are considered very highly in the 12-step world and in accordance with the 12 concepts. So this is a natural tension that we always have. And when we say majority rule, again, in the 12-step world, we have the idea of substantial unanimity. We make substantive determinations only with substantial unanimity, not just a simple majority. We will use a simple majority for many procedural questions so we can move on quickly and efficiently to the next thing. The rights of the chair to keep the meeting in line versus the rights of the assembly, which are very diffuse because there's so many different members in the assembly. But ultimately, as we say, the group conscience lies with the decisions of the assembly. So that's an attention. Flexibility versus finality. We want a large amount of flexibility to make sure we're right about things and we get all the different prospects in and considerations in and take them into account versus finality. Once you've made a decision, you don't want to have to, you don't want it to be changed really quickly, really easy, right away, because then people have no idea what's going to be governing them. That's why certain decisions are made much more difficult to change than others, the ones that are considered the most important. Intensity of concentration on a matter versus immediacy. And this has to do with when things can interrupt when you're in the middle of something. So all the rules that have been established over time through evolution of procedures are honed down to address these different tensions, all good things, but you can't have both at the same time, all the time. So depending on the circumstances, the rules are or the procedures are established. The required for required vote, what can be amended, what can be debated, what types of things can interrupt, what things can be reconsidered. And these same considerations underlie the standard procedures for recognition and debate and for decorum and debate. All these things, concerns are balanced to obtain the group conscience. Next slide, please. These are two quotations. They're very much in 19th century language, probably in 18th century language for the first quote, but they address underlying important principles I wanted to just briefly touch on. Whether these forms be in all cases the most rational or not is really not of so great importance. It is more material that there should be a rule to go by than what the rule is. In other words, you could spend endless time trying to get to the perfect, but if it's more important that people know what the rule is in advance, then try and spend meeting time fighting about getting good to perfect. Because anytime you set a rule in the middle of a meeting, inevitably someone is going to think that rule at the meeting was set in order to get to a substantive conclusion. Even if people really don't have that intention, it plants a seed in people's minds, where if the rules are known in advance, well before anything is discussed, they have the imprimatur of being much more neutral. And then I think this is the highest and most important value. The great purpose of all rules and forms is to serve the will of the assembly rather than to restrain it, to facilitate and not in obstruct the expression of the assembly's deliberative sense. That the rules are to help the conference get to the group conscience. It's not to show off who knows rules better than somebody else. It's not for the person who knows or thinks they know the rules to use the rules to get the substantive conclusion that they want. They're the purpose of the rules, and that is all about how they're going to be applied, is to make sure that the assembly gets to the group conscience that they need to get to. Then next slide, please. What does the parliamentarian do before the meeting? Has discussions with the chairs and board leadership about issues that are likely to come up, advises on different alternative methods of how to handle likely scenarios fairly and respectfully to all the participants. And helps maintain the chairs to ensure that the meetings are efficient and allow maximum freedom to explore possible alternatives during the meeting planning and at the meeting. Next slide, please. During the conference, during a physical conference, the parliamentarian sits beside the chair. At a virtual conference, parliamentarian is at all times available to the chair. Whether we're in person or virtually connected, effectively the parliamentarian is just next to the chair. gives advice quietly, in other words, confidentially, because the chair, it's the role of the chair to make that ultimate ruling, knowing the body in a way that the parliamentarian does not, and helps to prevent or correct procedural errors if issues of that nature come up. Next slide. After the conference, the parliamentarian will review the procedures that were used at the conference, offer feedback for possible improvements, and may be available if it's as a regular parliamentarian throughout the year as needed if issues come up that are likely to come up at meetings in the future. Next slide. Any questions? I don't see any hands raised at this time. Brad has a question.
Thank you, Michael. I call your attention to Article 9, paragraph 4 of the bylaws, which says that the group conscience of the members present provide direction to the board. Would a motion by a delegate to take a group conscience on a ruling by the chair be appropriate?
It is done under the 12 concepts and under the standard conference charter. I'm thinking about the ABA conference, the AA conference charter, and the conference charters for the parliamentary or for the other service organizations that I work with. And they all have a type of a supermajority where the conference could grant, give instructions, spiritually binding instructions to the board. Ultimately, the board has to make the legally binding decisions. And so, as it says here, it is not something that is that the board must legally follow, but should spiritually follow. That's what these bylaws say. That's very consistent with the standard AA approach. Because you know what? The conference could say, we want you to spend $100,000 on getting the word out to, you know, to the newcomer throughout the world about the benefits of ACA. But if the spending plan only has $20,000 available for everything, the board can't follow that. So the board has to bear in mind its fiduciary obligations and its financial obligations to the organized entity that is the board, and how what the board's role is for the fellowship as a whole.
I was thinking mostly about procedural issues, procedural matters, such as the OPPM has certain criteria that a floor motion must meet. Could the delegates not, by group conscience, vote to suspend or waive or eliminate that criteria?
Well, there that's procedure. That's really procedure. And there's a standard procedure called suspending the rules. And suspension of the rules would take any of the written rules that apply or customary rule and say, we don't want to use that procedure this time. We want to use another procedure. Typically, that would take a two-thirds vote because it disturbs the expected way that the group is going to address an issue. And anytime you do that, disturb expectations, usually it requires a supermajority. If you want to change the raw rule for the long term, you know, that would be bringing a motion to the floor about how what you want to be a binding rule, what you, not for you personally, but what you, the delegates as a whole working through the conference, want a procedure to be going forward. And yes, that's certainly a procedural method of doing
Thank you.
that. Okay. Let's move on to the next slide. I'll talk about the role of the delegate. So the role of the delegate is to serve as the voice and the voice of the fellowship as a whole by serving as a representative of the local group, intergroup, or region that has sent them to the ACA. And when I say representative, that means to represent that group's perspective and background and experience. It does not mean I'm going to vote on these things the way I believe my group wants me to do it, or with the interests of my group highest in mind. You have to be in a spiritual place where you're open to hearing the debate, everything everyone said, being educated, and then voting what each delegate thinks is the group conscience, the best result for the fellowship as a whole, not the interests of your own particular group. So even though you represent the individual group or intergroup that sent you, by bringing their perspective and experience, you are not bound by them, and you are not to proceed to vote as perceived by their interests, but rather the interests of the fellowship as a whole. And then after the meeting, the delegates carry the group conscience to their area, to their meetings, and they're supposed to inform people how the old decisions of the conference will affect the fellowship as a whole and their groups. Next slide. The conference chair and the parliamentarian, we've talked about a great detail before, and the role of the decision maker in that regard is going to be the chair, subject to the conference, the will of the conference. Let's move on. The point of order coordinator is going to be the person to whom a delegate raises possible rule violations, and then that the coordinator advises the parliamentarian and the chairs, who will then conference briefly and address the point of order that has been raised. A point of information or request for information. Again, we discussed this briefly before. Delegates can request procedural information through the request for information coordinator. It is then sent to the chair and the parliamentarians, who will discuss who in the room has the most knowledge about this particular issue and will be the best person to answer the request. And if the request is not on point to where the discussion is at that time, the response could also be, we'll answer you after the meeting, because that doesn't that that's not we don't have time for that right now. Something like that. Next slide. Okay, so then there's a particular coordinator for World Service Organization information, and that will be responded to questions about the World Service Office will be addressed by the appropriate person from the staff or the board, depending on what the question is. But like all questions that come up during the meeting, they need to be coordinated through the chair, because the role of the chair is to make sure the meeting runs efficiently, but also fairly, so that if a delegate needs information in order to process, maybe other delegates are also interested in the same information, we can get you the information that you need to address the meeting, and to participate fully, actively, and fairly in the meeting. Next slide. I've put together a few resource slides which will be available to you in the long after the meeting, I believe, will be circulated. This first page involves parliamentary guides. I've mentioned previously in the presentation what a parliamentary guide is, which is basically a set of meeting procedures that have been proved and demonstrated over time to be the most efficient ways to govern meetings. I have the most recent version of Robert's Rules of Order cited, and several other very commonly used parliamentary guides that are out there. And I mentioned before that I'm on the authorship team for two of those guides. One is the American Institute of Parliamentarians Standard Code of Parliamentary Procedure, and the other is Ray Kesey's Modern Parliamentary Procedure. Both of those guides use modern English and not a lot of that 19th century terminology that's off-putting to many people and has become certain fossilized terms that people hear at meetings and may not use in other contexts, and that causes confusion. So I'm very much into trying to use modern, up-to-date English. It's especially hard for people for whom English is a second language to then run up against some Latin term that has been used because it was used in the British Parliament in 1600. So that's my perspective. One of the citations here, Robbie Sabell's Rules of Procedure at the UN, that is the best guide that I know of to international parliamentary procedure or international meeting procedures. It's geared for the rules that apply in those bodies. And it's not just the UN, but all international intergovernmental conferences. A little bit higher level in detail than you need for a standard meeting of delegates who are not trained and paid to be essentially full-time diplomats. But at the same time, it provides a different perspective with which I am familiar on the concerns that may be raised in the context of international meetings as well. So, next slide, please. I put on this slide parliamentary articles and summaries. So, the summaries are two books that I highly encourage if you're interested in the subject of parliamentary procedure or meeting procedure as quick, easy, plain English guides to this area of the world. One is actually written by the authors of Robert's Rules and is intended to be a summary of the highlights of the rules because the Robert's Rules of Order in part became the guide to meeting procedures because it was only 175 pages long when it was first written. It's now 675 pages long because over the course of 150 years, they answered a lot of the questions that came in to fill in the gaps. Now it's mostly gap filling. And there are highlights, and the authors put them in this Roberts in brief. And that's the author's view, but because it's based on the original or the current version of Robert's Rules of Order, it still uses a lot of highly structured, fossilized 19th century language. And Jim Slaughter, who is a good friend of mine and an attorney and well-respected parliamentarian, has written a fast-track guide to Robert's Rules of Order and meeting procedure in general. And I highly recommend his book as an alternative. I've written some articles that address issues that have come up in this training. One is what is common parliamentary law. I established earlier in the meeting, or discussed earlier in the meeting, what common parliamentary law means, which is a consensus among the parliamentary guides as to a standard procedure that should be used in a particular circumstance. And when there's no real consensus, then we have a few alternatives, and the group can choose which alternative works best for it. That's what we mean by establishing common parliamentary law in substance. This article gets into it in greater detail. And then I wrote a couple of opinions when I was chair of the Opinions Committee of AIP that discusses in much more detail how we establish what a custom is when the custom is called into question. So those should be helpful to you. And the final, there's one more resource slide before questions, and it's an organizational resources slide. It's in the PowerPoint. This is ve just very briefly, organizations that provide lots of information about meeting procedures. And they're on this slide. You'll have that slide available to you, and you can explore those websites to your heart's content. And if you have questions that come from anything in this presentation or your review of these or other materials, please feel free to ask. Okay, we have about 20 minutes for questions, and we have a few hands raised. So Kaz S has not asked a question before. Can somebody unmute Kaz?
There we go. I have to confirm being unmuted. Okay. Thank you very much. You mentioned in your list of resources the article you wrote and the decision that you wrote with a citation for each. Are they actually available online? And if they're rather difficult, could you put into chat or some other or provide to Carmen or someone a way of getting access to those particular articles? The other material I think I can order from Amazon or something.
You're interested, yes. The article that I wrote on common parliamentary law is available on my web page, and the web page citation is there in the resources. The opinions are not readily available on any website, but I did extract them from the parliamentary journal that they're in, and I believe it's fair use to circulate among this group. And I have provided them to the meeting chairs and the board chair, and they would be available to you upon request.
Thank you.
Okay. Brad H. has a question.
Thank you, Michael. When I was a board trustee, the board was very inconsistent in insisting that certain provisions of the OPPM were followed and not so insistent on other provisions of the OPPM. What role would that type of inconsistency in application of the OPPM rules play in a procedural dispute?
Well, in this case, I'm a meeting procedures expert, and I'm not going to get involved in internal board procedures. Board procedures are tip whatever the board does within the board is by custom in most boards confidential, and they need to be confidential for very important reasons so that these people who are on the board, they owe a fiduciary, legal fiduciary obligation to the organization. They need to be free to say and do whatever is they think is important at the meeting without worrying about concerns that they might be deemed to have said something offensive or
I didn't make
something like that.
myself.
So they can say through this high con a level of confidentiality regarding how the board governs itself internally that I'm not going to be able to get into. It's
I did
really
not make
only
I did not make myself clear. I'm asking about a procedural question. If there is a procedural dispute over a rule in the OPPM, would the fact that the board has been inconsistent in insisting on compliance with that procedure, what would that play a role in your advice?
Well, it's really a concern more for the body because it's up to the body to determine what custom is. And if the body says, well, this OPPM procedure is written, we know what it is, but it hasn't been applied consistently, and we like this alternative better, then the body, by a majority vote, can establish what procedure it wishes to be followed by. But that has to do with establishing custom. And as I understand it, by custom, the OPPM is followed as written. And while there may be an exception to it from time to time, that's more in the nature of a suspension of the rules and was followed at the time. Suspension of the rules takes a two-thirds vote, but it can be done by general consent if there's no objection. So, if there was an inconsistency in following the OPPM in a particular instance, and the reason was for greater efficiency or to provide greater rights to the members to express themselves, it may be that it was an override in the nature of a suspension rather than failure to establish a rule. Ultimately, the body decides these issues. Charlie?
Yeah, actually, the body decides. Led me to point because when I was talking earlier, and I've been thinking about what you're saying about non-binding can still be psychologically binding. So how do you approach that in a way that doesn't lock people in the future? Pretty much my understanding is anything the conference decides in one setting can ultimately be overturned by another conference down the road if they follow the procedures to create something new. Is that a correct understanding? And I ask this because in one of my committees, we have people getting caught up on the word final. Is there any way, and my sense is there's no way that one conference can say something final for another conference, but I wanted to check that question out with you.
I would say conferences, yes. I mean, there are things that are so highly ranked, like the 12 concepts, that if you something goes against the 12 concepts, I would say you can't, no vote of an individual conference can override the 12 concepts. Ultimately, yes, there's a way to change the 12 concepts, but that goes, I think, to the, if I understand correctly, and the way they do it at AA, that goes to the groups, and the conference only has a role in facilitating getting that change to the groups. So the conference can't do everything, but it can do change things that are belong only to the conference. Okay, thank you.
Very good. Thank you.
Any further questions? Well, I don't see any hands raised. Carmen, I'll give it back to you at this point then.
Okay. All right. I'll just give it 30 seconds to see if anyone has any questions, particularly anyone that hasn't spoken. If you have any general questions about parliamentarian, role of parliamentarian, this is also a great time to answer or to ask. Okay, well, thank you, Michael. We'll go ahead and close out a little early. We'll close out with a serenity prayer. And would someone raise their hand to do the serenity prayer? I would like to do the serenity prayer.
Oh, wait, Denise R. had a hand raised briefly.
Oh, that was a hand clap.
Oh,
Good
sorry.
job.
Sorry to interrupt.